positive forum exploring the world's religions and spiritual belief systems as an on-air classroom in an effort to help people better understand each other, promote tolerance, and foster peace. I'm your host, Care Hallenbeck. Llewellyn Vaughn Lee, Ph.D., is an author and teacher in the Naqshbandi order of Sufism. He has specialized in the area of dream work, integrating the ancient Sufi approach to dreams with the insights of modern psychology. In recent years, the focus of his writing and teaching has been on spiritual responsibility in our present time of transition and the emerging global consciousness of oneness. His latest book is Prayer of the Heart in Christian and Sufi Mysticism, which explores the inner listening of the heart and the secret of prayer without ceasing, in which we discover how prayer becomes alive within the heart. This book brings together the Christian and Sufi mystical traditions in the oneness of love to which they both belong. It will benefit any practitioner of prayer, anyone who is drawn to discover a relationship with God within their heart. Llewellyn, welcome back to the program, and thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be with you again.
And salam. Now, Prayer of the Heart, your latest book, guides the reader through the stages of mystical prayer of two traditions.
Mm-hmm.
First, can I ask, what inspired you to write this book?
Yes, well, there are two, in a way, different reasons that drew me to write this book. And it's really, first, I should say, it's an offering of the heart. It just comes from that place within the heart where we all belong to God. All belong to God. And in recent years, I've been drawn more and more to try to articulate mysticism, this tradition that belongs to us all. We live in a time of so much division, of so much sectarianism. Mm. And yet deep within the heart of humanity, there is this single stream of mystical love that belongs to us all, whatever religious tradition, whatever belief system we have. Within the heart, there is this opening to God that, and some people who are called mystics are drawn to live and try to articulate this way to be with God deep within the heart.
Mm-hmm.
And a year ago, I actually published a book about my own very personal experiences as a mystic today called Fragments of a Love Story, because I am a Sufi, and for the Sufi, the relationship with God is as lover and beloved. In a way, the whole journey is a love story. And it was a very personal account of my own experiences on the mystical path. And then I was drawn to try to articulate, try to express what mystical prayer is, because for me, mystical prayer or prayer is very, very important. It's a way to be with God, a way to commune with God, a way for this relationship of lover and beloved, this deep companionship with God that is a very intimate inner experience within the heart. And then, as I said, there is a second reason, which at the time in which I was writing this book, I was in one of those places where everything seemed to have fallen away, and I just saw around me, particularly to do with the earth, which has touched me very deeply recently, this ongoing tragedy of how we are treating the earth, of how what we are doing, and in a way this rape and pillage of creation, this terrible exploitation. And it touched me very deeply. And I've always been very moved by Shakespeare. He was one of my earliest teachers. I was an English teacher in my late 20s. And my favorite play is his last play, The Tempest, where in a way this the world's greatest playwright says adieu to the stage. And he comes across in the figure of Prospero, who's a magician, who's a magus, who's a master. And at the very end of the story, when everything has been said, Prospero utters these very poignant lines, and he says, "And my ending is despair unless I be relieved by prayer."
Mm-hmm.
And it was as if this turning within my own heart, within my own soul, when there was nothing I could do but pray, I saw the world around me, I saw what was happening, and And in a way, all of the techniques, all of everything people were trying to do, but it still continued. And so I was drawn very deeply into prayer as if as a last call to God, as a last call to creation, as a last call to the beloved to help us. And so I tried to articulate what prayer means to me as a mystic.
Thank you so much, Llewellyn. You know, it does seem in our secular society that prayer may be sort of considered a last resort to many people, as you say, as everything is, you know, falling away around us. But that there is another way to life, and that can enhance life. And we, of course, in our journey on the program, go around the world to find all the many traditions that help to enhance and benefit our lives. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that rises up as we go through all the traditions of faith is this tradition of mysticism, mm-hmm. which seems to be, and I say rises up because it seems to be sort of, if you tease it out, it's a bridge that seems to unite mm-hmm. the faiths because of the nature of mysticism. When you say, for example, you know, mystical prayer is a way to create a living relationship with the divine within the heart, and that through mystical prayer, one is drawn beyond any words mm-hmm. into the interior silence of real communion with God. Can you share, then, what defines mystical prayer for people who may be familiar with prayer, basically in the more traditional sense of worshiping in their local parish?
Mm-hmm. Well, there are different forms of prayer, and in fact, as a mystic, you discover that everything, at its very core, everything is in a state of prayer. One great Sufi mystic, Dil Nun, he had an experience in which he saw all the fishes in the ocean were praising God. And yet most people are familiar with prayer, for example, the Lord's Prayer in the Christian tradition, which is a recitation of often very beautiful and very powerful words. And meditated myself on the Lord's Prayer a lot. In particular, this line, "May thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven." And mystical prayer seeks to go beyond words. It is really, because mysticism takes us beyond form into the formlessness of the divine. It speaks to that silence, that emptiness that is within us and around us, and belongs really to a direct mystical experience of a formless divinity, of God that is not personified, that has no image. But as one great Christian mystic, he talks about the dark silence in which all lovers lose themselves. And so for mystics, in a way, it is a way to go into a state of prayer that is deeper than words. I mean, Thomas Merton, the great Christian mystic, he said, "Silence is the language God speaks." And in fact, that is echoed by the founder of my Sufi order, Bahauddin Naqshband, who said, "God is silent and most easily reached in silence." And in fact, the Sufi order to which I belong, we're known as the silent Sufis because we do all our practices in silence. And it is really a way to access that deep interior silence, which is beginning to be a state of listening to God, a state of inner receptivity. And then becomes a state of being absorbed by God, about being drawn deeper and deeper and deeper into this emptiness, this silence that calls us within the heart, that is, becomes a direct experience of divine love.
You know, and it's interesting when we mention listening. Along my journey of studies, I learned that the word obedience, first of all, which has rather negative connotation in the West, as being, you know, subservient or, you know, some other form. At its root, the etymology of the word means to listen, to give ear to.
I didn't know that. That's
beautiful. So when we are obedient, we are really listening.
It is.
You know, to another or to God.
Yes, interior prayer is a deep state of listening, a state of divine receptivity.
Now,
Sorry?
If I could ask a little more about your own journey. I was not aware that you were an English teacher in your 20s. We have a lot in common there. I studied the classical stage in my undergraduate education, so we can discuss Shakespeare more if you like. But could you share a little bit as well? Now, did you have a background? Were you raised in a particular faith? Say, were you of a Christian background and then discovered Sufism?
I was raised in the Christian tradition. My father was deeply Christian in a religious rather than spiritual sense. And one of the wonderful things is he used to love church architecture and church music. And so as when young children, he used to take me and my sister, who was 1 year older than me, to church every Sunday, and we would go around to different churches and cathedrals, for example, Wells Cathedral in the western part of England, which is incredibly beautiful. And they had a cathedral choir there. And so I was immersed in that aspect of Christianity from an early age, and also in reading the Bible, because at school and that we studied the Bible. And I'm very, very grateful for that. What I would say is, as I say, it was a Christian religion rather than spirituality. In this Christian environment, there was no notion that one could, for example, have a direct relationship to God. The aspect of really an interior experience didn't belong to the religion of my childhood. And in my early teens, I drew away from the church and then actually began to practice Zen Buddhism, in which drew me very much into interior states of meditation. And then I met a Sufi teacher when I was 19. And then actually what happened, Kerr, is that I was about 36, 37, and I was invited to give a seminar at a Roman Catholic retreat center in Florida, which surprised me. And because of that, I studied the Christian mystics, and in particular the writings of St. Teresa of Avila, whom I hadn't read before. She's since then become a great favorite. And I was deeply, deeply moved to discover in these Christian mystics the same inner experiences that I had had within the Sufi tradition, and particular in St. Teresa, who articulates the stages of prayer, I think, more explicitly and more beautifully than any other Christian writer I've come across. And I discovered they were the same as my own experiences of deepening meditation within the Sufi tradition, this journey into the heart, this journey into interior silence that takes one into states of union, into states of ecstasy. And this was deeply reassuring to, you know, she had a very, very difficult life. She was and very much under the watchful eye of the Inquisition, who at that time did not actually allow nonverbal prayer. It was actually forbidden, and she had to do it in secret. She practiced something called the prayer of quiet, which is a state of inner receptivity within the heart. And yet, in her later years, she articulated these stages of prayer. And so what I wanted to write about mystical prayer is to show within the Christian and Sufi tradition, it's the same. We have the same heart, you know.
Yes. And this practice allows us to transcend these differences. And I hear you making that distinction between Christian spirituality and the Christian religion, because all too often we, you know, hear the story of people who have, let's say, just thrown out the baby Jesus with the bathwater, as it were. What I call the institutional church.
I mean, this was a very conscious decision, as far as I understand, of the Catholic Church in its early years to become a worldly institution. And
right.
Gnostics were persecuted, and a lot of the esoteric traditions of Christianity became repressed or became lost. And in fact, the Eastern Orthodox Church kept them more alive, and we can later, if you like, talk about the Jesus Prayer.
Yeah,
within the Eastern Orthodox tradition, which is a form of mystical prayer that is very, very beautiful and very powerful.
Yes.
And they are about direct experience, not about hearing somebody else talk about it, but about the direct experience that really is our human heritage, that we have the capacity to have a direct inner experience of the divine that is beyond any sectarianism, any outer division.
and you were able to make this great connection with the Christian mystics. And, you know, I'll include someone like Francis of Assisi, who could, you know, celebrate all of creation, the oneness. He became very attuned to.
Well, there's actually a tradition that the present Christian mystic, Richard Rohr, reminded me of, in that St. Francis was actually very influenced by the Sufis. He was a knight who followed the Crusades.
That's right.
And in the Middle East, there's a tradition that he met Sufis, and there he had, in a way, an awakening that he brought back to the West, which is to do with love and to do with the mystical power of love and his heart-centered spirituality that is...
And he couldn't fight anymore.
He couldn't fight anymore, because once you experience that, you don't want to fight. The greater jihad is actually the war against the nafs, against the lower self that stands in the way of your relationship to God.
So you have pulled together in your latest work... The impact of St. Teresa of Avila and other Sufi and Christian saints and mystics. Mm-hmm. Can you describe them? I know you have John of the Cross in there and Rumi. Why these particular folks? And feel free to discuss it, each one at length.
Well, St. Teresa, because, as I said, she has articulated the stages of mystical prayer most beautifully. And she was a profound mystic, and she lived it as well as taking the Carmelite order back to its state of essential poverty.
Right.
Tremendously inspiring. And then she had this very particular relationship with John of the Cross, in that he became the confessor to her nuns. And he was an extraordinary mystic himself, and has given us this articulation of what he calls the dark night of the soul, which is a particular aspect of the mystical journey that is terribly, terribly difficult. And he, of course, experienced it through being imprisoned by his fellow monks because of his spirituality and being forbidden to take the sacrament, as well as being incredibly badly treated. And it's this moment in the journey when everything turns against you, when you lose all of your beliefs because they're kind of uprooted from within you, and you stare into what I call the darkness of God. And it is a step on the journey that, in a way, separates the real mystic from those who just want to taste the spiritual journey, because it's devastating. But he describes it incredibly beautifully, as well as writing a lot of beautiful mystical poetry. And, as I say, he had this very beautiful link with St. Teresa. He was a young when she was already quite old, and
she kind of gave him a job, and
she did.
And together
after he escaped from the monastery in which he was imprisoned. And so to me they go together very beautifully, and
they do, and there's a lot of almost opposites attract in them, where she's very straightforward and down to earth in her in her actions and her vocabulary, and of course he's very just beautiful and lofty and impacted by the I think also the Muslim influence in Spain.
Yes,
where
he
grew up.
Yes, there was a great
Sufi
mystical heritage was still alive in Spain at that time, although it had been repressed by the Christians.
Yeah.
And he, of course, died quite young, unlike St. Teresa, who lived to a good age.
Yes, that's true. Well, he died of his wounds and illness in prison, of course.
Yes.
I think he was 41 or 42.
I think so, yes.
But left behind this amazing wealth of the poetry we still study today. Now, can you share also some more about Attar, about Rumi, and the connections between these great souls?
Yes, Rumi is, of course, well known in the West today. He's apparently the most popular poet in the West, partly through the tremendous work of Coleman Barks, who translated him and made him accessible to us in the West. And he describes mystical love, divine love, like nobody else, really. The beauty, the wonder, the intoxication, the majesty, the glory, the humanness also of mystical love. And so... And there are, of course, many, many other Sufi poets. One of the slightly sad things of this emphasis on Rumi is many of the other great Sufi poets who talk about mystical love are not so well known. And one of the better known is Attar, who wrote this amazing little book called The Conference of the Birds that describes the whole mystical journey, what he calls the valleys of the quest. And it is, in a way, a most straightforward manual written in a very poetic sense of this interior journey. And so I have used him very much as a poetic device to describe the stages of this inner journey within the Sufi tradition, the valley of bewilderment, the valley of love. And he uses stories to describe what happens to the wayfarer on the stages of this journey. And the mystical journey has actually been mapped out by people like Saint Teresa or people like Attar very carefully.
Yeah.
And to one of the great joys you discover when you read these people is it's the same journey. It's the same journey into love and the same journey within the heart that they are describing, and it has very similar stages, even written at different times in very different cultures.
Well, there must be something going on there to make that kind of connection across time and space.
And it's still alive today. You know,
yeah.
We have so much division, but this stream of mystical love is still present within our hearts and souls. And it is a great human heritage, I feel. And as it seems, humanity is going through this time of turbulence, of crisis, however you see it, outwardly, inwardly. It is, I think, invaluable to reconnect with the deepest aspects of our heritage, of what we have been given as human beings. And mysticism is, I think, in many ways the most important rooted connection to the divine in this life. And I suppose I speak as a mystic. I feel if you don't have a connection to the divine in your life, in whatever way it comes through, in whatever way it expresses itself, life must be very difficult. There was an English mystical painter called Cecil Collins, and he said, it's difficult to live a dream, but even more difficult to live without a dream. And how can you survive without a lived connection to the divine? And this is the mystics give us this heritage we have, give us this connection. They lived it, they suffered it. One great Sufi says, there has to be blood. They bled for it, even not outwardly, they bled for it inwardly.
Well, and you know, Llewellyn, everyone is so busy today and so task-oriented and perhaps become more, you know, humans doing than human being.
Yes, that's true. I remember when in the 90s the computers were going to make us a leisure society.
Really?
I remember that. And there was this whole thing, we're only going to be able to work 3 days a week, and
right.
What are we going to do with the rest of the time that this computer society is giving to us.
Well, thank you for reminding us of that, because, you know, recently there was a study that showed that 14% of Americans actually feel a feeling of panic if they cannot see where their cell phone is.
What a strange.
And, you know, when we talk about, as you said, Teresa of Avila, you know, she compares souls without prayer to literally to paralysis.
Yes, I mean, I think
so. Let's share a little more now then about the role of prayer and the stages of prayer.
Yes, I mean, for me, really, the most important aspect of prayer has to do with companionship. This is a beautiful saying: "I am the companion of he who remembers me." And real prayer is about remembrance, about reconnecting with the living presence of God. And from that, there comes this companionship within the heart, within one's life. Many people today feel quite alone, quite isolated, despite our whole interconnected world. And through prayer, you talk to God, or you listen to God, or you're in communion with God. For the Sufis, I say, we call him the beloved. There's a lovely poem by one of the great early Christian Sufi mystics called Rabia, who was a woman. She was actually born into slavery, and she said, "O my Lord, the stars glitter and the eyes of men are closed. Kings have locked their doors and each lover is alone with his love. Here I am alone with you." And I remember when, for example, I was a young parent and I was teaching and life was very, very busy. And then at the end of the day, children would be asleep. Often my wife would have fallen asleep because she was so tired after yeah. early in the evening. And then I would have this time alone and I could lie down and turn towards the wall and go into my heart. And there my beloved would be there, and there would be this time just to be alone with God. And, you know, now 30 years later, I often say to myself, oh, I just want time to be alone with God. And there's this deep inner relationship, this companionship. He becomes your companion, or she becomes your companion, depending how you experience the divine. And later, of course, it becomes a waking presence too. He's with you wheresoever you turn. There's this ongoing relationship with the divine in all of one's waking life, and then you have prayer as a way to really to reconnect, to reestablish, to be alone with God, to bring that living relationship, both in times of deep interior prayer, when you're just quiet, the doors are closed, and you just turn within your heart and your beloved is waiting for you. Your friend is there. This is one of the Sufi expressions of God, is to call him, he is our friend. And it's a deep, deep friendship. And you talk to your friend, or you listen to your friend, or you're just there with your friend. It becomes just a feeling of love within the heart, because that is, of course, one of the primal expressions. The way God comes to meet you is through the energy of love. And you just feel this love. You feel this relationship of love. And I just wonder how people can live without that. Life must be so difficult. Must be, how do you do anything? How do you make it through the day in this world we have at the moment, if you don't have this inner connection, if you don't have this love, if you don't have a way to be in prayer? But
I would suggest we have the world that we live in today because of that disconnection.
I think you are right. I think that is very, very, very true. And
I think perhaps
sad.
All our, you know, our lower desires, or, you know, greed, whatever, you know, me first mentality mm-hmm. has been running rampant, and we see the devastation now that comes from that way of life.
But seem unable to do anything about it except these little places of light, like the program you have to remind people there is a, you know, these little sparks of light to remind people there is a different way to be. We don't have to be caught up in this nightmare of materialism that is devouring everything in the
right
in the planet. And what I would like to talk about later is how it is devouring not just the outer ecology of the planet, the
yes.
visible world, but it is also devouring what is sacred within
and we will
interior world.
But I feel like this necessity of prayer that you're discussing, whether it, no matter what tradition, is essential. It's not another task to get to, which may be how
breathing.
It's being perceived.
That's why in many forms of prayer with the breath, it is a way to breathe. It is a way to be alive. It is a way to... And there are many, many different forms of prayer. Here I'm just talking about silent mystical prayer. I wrote a piece that just came out on the Huffington Post when I talk about a different form of prayer, which is my early walk in the morning when I go for a walk first thing in the morning after meditating. I go for a walk, I happen to live in nature, which is a great blessing, and seeing the natural world around me, and there is this communion, there is this prayer with the created world, with this incredibly beautiful world of forms that is an expression of God. And there are many, there is a way to pray when you cook. I never knew, you know, that food could taste of love until my teacher first cooked a meal for me. I never knew you could taste love. And there is, as many people know, there is a way to cook with love that is a prayer. And then people experience it, because people are nourished not just by the physical food, but by the love within the food.
Mm.
And that is a real meal. The real people come together, friends come together, lovers come together. And it is a real meeting of love and also prayer. And this, of course, used to be part of every indigenous culture.
Right.
Everything in their life.
And communion comes to mind as well.
Yes.
Infusing that energy of love.
Yes, it is communion.
Into sharing even just a daily meal.
even just a daily meal. Yes, I think people, that's why I feel you need to cook your own food. You need to share your own love.
True nurturing. We're about halfway through the program. Stay on the line. You are listening to the Godspeed Institute live on the Progressive Radio Network. We're going to take just a short break, but when we return, we'll continue our conversation on prayer of the heart in Christian and Sufi mysticism with Llewellyn Vaughan Lee. Let's spend a couple of minutes now with Bob Carlyle. Stay with us.
It was said this man was of no reputation, yet he could stop a rising storm with a gesture of his hand. But he chose to use his hands to heal. Hearts of darkness, hearts of stone, just like a man of no reputation, by the wise considered a fool. When he spoke about faith and forgiveness in a time when the strongest all rule. But this man of no reputation loved the weak with relentless affection, and he loved all those Spirit, just as they were. He was a man of no reputation. It was said this man brought only confusion, that he'd achieve his ends by any means.
Welcome back to the Godspeed Institute. You are live with CARE, and we're talking about prayer of the heart in Christian and Sufi mysticism with Llewellyn Vaughan Lee. And that was Bob Carlyle with some of his song, Man of No Reputation, and the lyric, The Hearts of the Captive Were His Only Concern. A song about Jesus, but which we are discussing today, relates to all the mystical traditions, including Sufism. The evolution of the heart is a great concern of today's guest,
yes.
Llewellyn Vaughan Lee. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
As a matter of fact, I imagine the evolution of the heart is pretty much the essential key to all movement at this point, whether it's people, whether it's business, whether it's our relationship with money and the earth. Of course, the evolution of the heart, one by one, and this is a lot of your work at this time.
Yes, well, as a Sufi mystic, I believe in the primacy of the heart. The heart is the place where we can have the most direct connection to God, and where we can commune to God with God, where we can listen to God, and the prayer of the heart takes one into that sacred place. And also, you know, the world also has a heart. This is something that has been forgotten. I think it is one of the great, I call it great unspoken tragedy of the present time. But it's interesting that we recognize that we have a soul. In fact, a lot of contemporary spiritual work is about reconnecting with our own soul or doing soul work, because we realize that only through a connection with our soul can life become really meaningful. And, you know, one of the great lies of our material culture is that outer stuff will make us happy. And it's sold by multinational corporations and very powerfully manipulated symbols and images in advertising that kind of grip our collective, that by going to the mall, which is apparently the great defining pastime of the American collective today, that is what will fulfill us. And many people have woken out of that nightmare, that horrible self-destructive dream, and they said, or their souls have woken them up and said, no, that isn't true, that we have a soul, and the soul is what gives meaning to your life, and you need to reconnect to your soul in whatever way you can. But what I find sad is that people haven't taken it a step further and said, but actually the world also has a soul. This was understood by the ancients. They called it the anima mundi, the soul of the world. And we are now waking up to what is called this Gaia awareness, the awareness that the earth is a living being, an incredibly beautiful, interconnected, balanced ecosystem that is alive, called Gaia. What we don't seem to have realized yet is that the world actually has a soul, and the soul of the world is starving at the moment, just as our own soul will be starving if we only regarded ourselves as physical objects to be mistreated. And we really need to reconnect with the soul of the world, just like we really need to reconnect with our own soul. We need to reconnect with the soul of the world because we are part of it. The great psychologist Carl Jung, he actually talked about this tragedy of when human beings forgot that the spark of their soul was part of the spark of the world's soul, and there became this split between the human being and the created world. And the world is dying, and what I regard as the great unspoken tragedy is it's not only dying physically, and we know that with this terrible species depletion, with the acidification of the oceans, with global warming, we are destroying the balance of this ecosystem. People now talk about reaching the tipping point, which means if you go beyond that point, we have no idea what is going to happen. All of the models that we have of climate, of weather, of the behavior of the ecosystem become disturbed, become upset. Nobody knows what's going to happen. And we have also reached, people don't realize, a spiritual tipping point to the world. The world is also a spiritual living organism, and it nourishes our soul, you know. It speaks to our soul. This is part of the mystery of being alive. People often feel it in nature, the magic, this meeting place that their soul is spoken to. And this is part of one of the great mysteries of creation, the great mystery of being alive. The Christian mystic Thomas Berry, he talks about this quality of wonder in creation, which we need to reclaim, whereas the English mystical poet Hopkins, he talks about the world is charged with the grandeur of God. And we have forgotten this, and there is this devastation that's happening to the inner world, to the spiritual body of the planet, that occasionally shamans, people like the Kogi in Colombia, warn us about this deep spiritual imbalance. But, you know, one of the great tragedies of our present culture, and it is in a way an even greater tragedy because it is hardly known, is we have dismissed the inner world as a culture. We have forgotten about it. And we have forgotten about it to such a degree we have even forgotten that we have forgotten. I call this analogous to, there have been times in civilization's history when they burnt the books. One thinks of the burning of the library in Alexandria that held all the wisdom of centuries, and it was all lost. Or, for example, in South America, the Mayan library, this incredible library that had over 3,000 volumes, the Spanish Catholic Church systematically destroyed the whole library, and now there are just a few fragments left, and they had this deep understanding of the spiritual dimension of time, of the meanings of the cycles of time that we don't have. Mm. And there is a desire at some point in civilizations to eradicate the knowledge of the past, to destroy it to such a degree that the culture doesn't even remember that it was there. And this is what has happened to do with the inner worlds, which if you go to any indigenous culture or any shaman, they say, of course, you have to live in relationship to the inner world. You can't just live on the surface of the world. You have to have a relation to the magical, mythical dimension of the interior world.
Yes, the distinction between us and the world and or the earth is an illusion.
Yes, we are part of it, and our soul is also part of it. And the fact that we have exploited the world, we have desecrated it to such a degree, has had this devastating effect on the interior world in the soul. And and it is crying to us. In fact, the Zen master, Thich Nhat Hanh, was once asked what we need to do to save the world. And he said, what we most need to do, he replied, is to hear within us the sounds of the earth crying.
Mm.
And we don't even know how to listen to the soul of the world anymore. We don't even know that it has a soul. And
yeah, the disconnection has become so extreme.
It has.
For so many.
I remember in my own life, because as I say, I was brought up in a religious background, but not a spiritual background. And I can remember what it was like when I realized that nobody around me as a child would recognize that I had a soul. I can remember the bleakness. It's one of those very early memories I've carried within me.
Hmm.
And it's like part of me shut off. I went into this gray world. I went into this world where there was no color, there was no light, there was no joy for many, many years. And then when I was 16, something, a light switched on inside me, and suddenly the whole world changed. And suddenly I connected with my own soul, and suddenly there was color, there was beauty, there was a song in the world around me, there was joy. I didn't even know joy existed.
Mm.
And later I discovered love. And, you know, once you know what it's like to live without a connection to your soul, then you know how incredibly important it is. And it is like that for the earth. But our soul, it is nourished by the soul of the earth. There is, the Sufis talk about this sacred substance in creation.
Yes.
They have this expression, the secret of the word kun, to be. The whole secret of creation is really that it is a manifestation of the divine. And it is that divine substance within creation that nourishes our soul. Now, because we have dismissed the inner world of creation very, very systematically, it was done in the early years of Christianity. They got rid of all the pagan religions. The sacred groves were burnt down. It was done slightly differently in North America by the Christians and their treatment of the Native Americans, the first peoples here. We lost this awareness of the sacred nature of creation. We lost this connection to the substance in creation, and we lost an awareness of the inner world.
Mm.
And then we decided we can do with the earth what we want. We can use it as our plaything. We can use it to exploit for our own greed, for our own material progress.
Mm.
And what we did not realize is what we were destroying, the very substance that nourishes us as human beings. The very substance that gives life meaning here, that makes life sacred. And then that's why, for example, the Kogi in Colombia are so horrified at what we are doing. They refer to themselves as the elder brothers because they hold this original wisdom, and they talk about us as the younger brothers. And they are horrified what we are doing because they can see it. They have been trained to see the inner worlds, like shamans are trained to see the inner worlds.
Hmm.
And they can see how we are destroying this very substance within life that makes life sacred, that makes life have meaning. And we don't know what we are doing. And as I say, the real tragedy from my point of view is because it has been so systematically erased from our collective consciousness, because that sacred library has been burned to such a degree, we don't have any idea of what we are doing. It is the greatest unreported tragedy of the present time that we are destroying the spiritual body of the world. We are destroying, just as we are destroying the outer ecosystem, we are destroying the inner ecosystem, what makes life sacred. I was very intrigued to read recently in a book by the Prince of Wales, who's written this beautiful book, Harmony, about the ecological situation, and he talks about how we have destroyed the outer nature and also the inner nature. And yet this is something that even ecologists who really care about the well-being of the world don't want to go to, don't want to enter, because maybe it is too new age. It is the least new age thing.
I know, it's the most ancient wisdom.
It is the most ancient. The animal mundi is the most ancient understanding of the world as a living spiritual being.
And you know, Llewellyn, as you speak, so many things come to mind. And one of them, I mean, the phrase sacred substance, mm-hmm. as you know, I may have shared previously, is one that's been working in my mind mm-hmm. lately. And I gave an interview not too long ago about the space sciences and religion. And that I believe this is where we're heading, is to re-identifying or rediscovering that sacred substance that everything is made of, and not only mm-hmm. ourselves and this earth, but, you know, the universe.
Oh, yes.
At
Absolutely.
Large. And someone like, for example, Martin Luther mm-hmm. Considered grace itself, a mm-hmm. substance.
It is, yes.
And, for example, going into, you know, communion, that, mm-hmm. that this bread is infused with the sacred substance.
Yes,
of grace as a tangible thing.
Mm-hmm. It is. No, it is. It's a light. You can see it in meditation. It's a light.
Yes. And also you mentioned Thomas Berry before. Mm-hmm. He and Brian Swim wrote a wonderful book called The Universe Story.
Yes.
That was one of my favorites. That's like a retelling of the creation story, a little more, you know, from the scientific and spiritual point of view.
Brought together, yes.
And it's lovely. And they share the, you know, development of the elements as though they were calling the choirs of angels.
Yes.
It's a beautiful book. I'd recommend as well. And now, so you refer to, for example, divine unity, a merging and melting that transcends the mind and its notions of duality. Mm-hmm. And to me, this is exactly where it comes together, this notion that there is myself and other mm-hmm. Melts away.
It is one of the great myths of the last era that we are separate. This is, if you actually begin to have experiences of oneness, it is ridiculous. And what is interesting is that science, subatomic science, has become to be aware of that, and also now ecology is becoming aware that we are one living ecosystem. We are interdependent, or there's a phrase, a Buddhist phrase, interbeing, which is lovely. We are one, we are interbeing. And then you see the world very differently. And say one of the great sadnesses is we haven't taken responsibility for the world as one living interbeing of which we are a part. We still treat it as something out there, and that's why I say the world is not a problem to be solved. It is a living being to be related to.
Right. That's where the healing begins.
Human beings are not problems.
Yeah.
They are divine beings, and it's a feminine quality, relating, relationship. We have to learn again how to relate to creation. And with all the goodwill in the world, we can't solve the problems we have created with the same mindset of separation that has caused them. We have to learn to listen to creation, and that's where I also bring in prayer, because prayer is a way of listening. And to listen to the heartbeat of the world, to listen to the voices within creation. Just like you, if somebody is in distress, you have to learn to listen to them. You listen, the Sufis talk about the eye of the heart and the ear of the heart. And you know if somebody is listening to you, you know if they are receptive. And something in you opens up, and then a real healing can come just from being listened to, just from being heard. And we need to listen again to creation. This is, all indigenous people knew how to listen to creation, both outwardly to the winds, to the seasons, to the rains, to and also inwardly to the inner sounds of creation, to the inner music of creation. So if something was out of balance, they could work to put it back in balance. And now we have a whole ecosystem disastrously out of balance, and we don't know what to do.
Yes.
We don't even want to do anything. We don't, you know, you look at what's happened in the Rio summit.
Yeah. And
for example, yeah. In the earlier summits, they used to talk about sustainability, and now they talk about sustained growth. We want to continue our myth of economic growth. It is disastrous.
Yes, the myth, yes. Now let me pull, because you're referring to prayer again, and mm-hmm. as we, you know, head towards the last part of the program, mm-hmm. I do want to return to prayer,
mm-hmm.
because part of this, you know, being out of alignment as we are, mm-hmm. With our, you know, divisions between ourselves and the earth, but also our divisions among each other,
mm-hmm.
That we're clinging to, can result in painful events such as, for example, a Christian minister wanting to burn a Quran that he's likely never read. And a purpose of this program and our organization, of course, is to be dedicated to that listening,
mm-hmm.
and listening to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And you're in a position where you have actually found commonality among the mystics of Sufism, the Islamic mm-hmm. Mystical tradition, and Christian mystics. Could you share some about the Jesus prayer? And
yes, this belongs
again the power of the name, and please yes. share some of that, of where this common ground can be enjoyed.
I mean, the Jesus prayer is, which is the simple repetition of the phrase, Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me. Or even just, Lord Jesus Christ, have mercy on me. Or you can also add a sinner at the end, have mercy upon me, a sinner. This is found within the Orthodox Eastern Christian tradition. There's a beautiful book called The Way of a Pilgrim, which describes a Russian pilgrim who used this as his main spiritual practice. And it can be said with the breath, or it can just be, it can be said all day, or it can be said as a focus, as an intention. And this is very, very similar to the Sufi zikr, which is the repetition of the name of God, or a sacred saying like La ilaha illallah, that works with the breath. And it is really has to do with the power of the name and the esoteric power of the name, that if you repeat the name of God, you align yourself with the divine. And eventually, through that alignment, there is a merging, there is a oneness. Or, to put it differently, you begin to become aware of your primordial state of union with God. We are always with God. There is nothing other than God. But one of the great secrets of being a human being is that we are not aware of that. I always think it is like the story of the fishes who went in search of water. We are not aware of this divine that we swim in, that we are part of. And so there are these simple techniques, and real mystical techniques are usually very, very simple, to reawaken us, to lift the veils. And the repetition of a sacred name is one of those ancient techniques that has been given to humanity. And I say given because it wasn't discovered. These great spiritual things, they are gifts, they're given from the inner world, they're given from the world of mystery, and they are given to humanity as tools to reconnect us with our divine nature, which is that we are one with God and one with everything around us. And there are stages on the path of mystical prayer. As I said, in the St. Teresa, there are these stages of this inner silence, of being absorbed deeper and deeper into states of union, and then into states of ecstasy. And they are similar in the Jesus prayer and the zikr, except they have a different quality, because you are actually reciting the name. For the Sufi, it is the name of the one we love.
Mm.
I always think, if somebody were to say to you, you're going to repeat the same word over and over again for the rest of your life, you would say, I'd get bored. And what is interesting, Kara, when you do the zikr, you don't get bored, because you are repeating the name of the one you love. You're repeating the name of your beloved. And so each moment is a new moment, a new opportunity to repeat the name of God. I remember when I was first given the Zikr in my 20s, I thought, how wonderful, because no moment can ever be wasted. If I am waiting at a bus stop, and I lived in England at the time, and you spend a lot of time in England waiting at bus stops.
Mind the gap.
And, you know, no time is wasted, because you are always repeating the name of the one you love. And if you wake up in the night and you are anxious, you are repeating the name of the one you love. You are invoking that name, and it is said, I am the companion of he who remembers me. And out of it, there develops this companionship, this relationship of love. And what is mysticism really at its core? It's about a relationship of love. Just as we have outer relationships of love with other human beings, mysticism is about an inner relationship of love with God, and a relationship that deepens and deepens and deepens until finally there is this experience of merging, of being absorbed by love. I use this expression of being taken by love to love. And you are drawn back to love. It is through grace rather than through effort. In fact, in St. Teresa's Stages of Prayer, she uses the image of the gardener watering the garden. And at the beginning, he has to make a lot of effort to take the water out of the well. And the last stage of prayer, it just rains. Grace. It just rains. You don't do anything. And you are taken back to this state of merging, this mystery that we are one with God. And I think if the mystic has to contribute anything to humanity at this time, it is to remember we are all one, this oneness of being the Sufi talks about. We are all one, and God is one. There are no two gods. God is one. We may experience it in different ways, just like we each have our own unique experience of life. And God is one, and God calls to us. He wants us to experience, or she wants us to experience, this primordial oneness, that we are one with God. And the earth also needs us. It is also calling to us. And prayer is a way to respond to that calling. It is very powerful. If people knew how powerful prayer was, they wouldn't cease from prayer for a moment.
Well, Llewellyn, on that note, I just want to thank you so much for being on the program today. I want to let listeners know that your website and contact information and your wonderful book links will be posted on our homepage shortly at GodspeedInstitute.com. Thank you again for being on the program and for all of your love as well.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to share with you a little of this mystery of love.
And thank you, listeners, for joining us on the Godspeed Institute today. This program was recorded live on the Progressive Radio Network in New York City and was produced by Michael Hallenbeck. If you'd like to hear this or any of our previous programs again, or send it to someone, simply go to GodspeedInstitute.com. And remember to join us again as we continue to explore all of the world's religions and spiritual belief systems right here on PRN.FM. Until then, we wish you Godspeed on your journey.